Good evening. Thank you so much for coming out. I'd like to introduce our panelists. To my far left is Matthew Nod. He's the environmental coordinator for the city of Ann Arbor. He staffs the city's environmental commission and supports a broad range of city sustainability projects. He's also a member of the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, and that's a peer-to-peer learning network of 160 sustainability directors. He was a member of the U.S. EPA Board of Scientific Counselors Sustainable and Healthy Communities Subcommittee. He holds master's degrees from the University of Michigan in biology and public policy. And then next we have Jeff Masters. He's the director of meteorology at the Weather Underground, which he co-founded in 1995. He writes one of the most popular weather and climate blogs, climate change blogs on the internet. Before that, he taught weather forecasting to undergrads at SUNY Brockport and then became a hurricane hunter. I'd like to hear more about that. And a flight meteorologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Aircraft Operations Center. Jeff earned his PhD in air pollution meteorology at the University of Michigan. And last, we have Andy Hoffman. He's the Holcomb Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. That means he holds joint appointments in the Ross School of Business and the School for Environment and Sustainability. Before joining the academic world, Andy worked for the U.S. EPA as an environmental consultant and a senior fellow with the Meridian Institute. He earned a PhD in management and civil and environmental engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. All right, so we're going to jump right in. We're going to start out just having a panel discussion, and then we'll open it up for questions from all of you. So let's start with the Cliff Notes version of the Paris Climate Accord. On December 12, 2015, 195 nations made a pact to adopt green energy sources, cut down on climate change emissions, and limit the rise of global temperatures. They pledged to work together to cope with the impact of unavoidable climate change. The core goal of the agreement is to hold the increase in global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So, Jeff, let's start with you. What does a 2-degree rise look like?
We're already at a 1-degree rise. So you take what we've done over the past 100-plus years, and you double that, and we're expected to get there maybe as soon as 20 years from now. And we're already seeing a sharp increase in the number of heavy precipitation events. That is the extreme rainfall events most likely to cause flash floods. We've seen a sharp increase also in heat waves and extreme heat events. Didn't have so much of that this summer. Ann Arbor lucked out with a good summer this year. But if you remember back in the summer of 2012, we had 30 or so days above 90 degrees and 3 days above 100 degrees. That's kind of the summer that we're going to see routinely if we have a 2-degree centigrade rise in global temperatures. So a lot more heat, a lot more heavy rain events, and when it's dry, when we get droughts, those droughts are going to be a lot more intense. So here in Michigan, we're pretty well prepared for that kind of eventuality, but the globe is not. That kind of a weather scenario is going to play havoc with crops, for instance. And drought is my number one concern in a 2-degree centigrade warmer world. It's going to put a big stress on crops to try and grow in that sort of heat when the rains don't come. Things are going to dry out a lot more, crops are going to fail, and our interconnected world is going to have trouble feeding it all.
Let's talk about heat records. Where are we standing with record heat?
We've just completed a 3-year period of the warmest year on record, year after year after year, globally. This year's not going to be quite as warm. We're probably going to finish as the second hottest year on record. But just last month, July, that was the hottest month in human history, recorded history, going back to the 1870s. And more of the same coming as we continue to pump more greenhouse gases into the air.
What if we don't limit temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius?
Well, the odds are we're not going to. If all of the commitments of the Paris Accord are fulfilled, we're going to see about a 3.5-degree centigrade warmer world. So we're going to have to do a lot more than what Paris put out there to hold it to 2 degrees centigrade. And frankly, it's going to be difficult to hold our current sort of civilized world together in that kind of situation without a lot of adaptation, a lot of forethought, planning to adjust to the coming storms and droughts and heat waves.
Well, lastly, last question for you, Jeff. We often hear people in the media ask scientists, about single extreme weather events. Given what we know about climate change, and you and I have talked about this and how climate change loads the dice from the increased chance of extreme weather events, is there any point to trying to tie a single extreme weather event to climate change?
There is. In fact, we're starting to do that routinely now. Whenever there's a major extreme weather event that could be affected by climate change, we have a group of scientists that go out there and run computer models to try and figure out, you know, maybe this was affected by climate change. What they can do is they can run the weather systems in a theoretical sense when there was no human-caused impact, you know, say what it would have been in the Industrial Revolution, and then they run it with the current climate and they see what the difference is. They're called attribution studies. And I think they're very valuable because they tell the public that, hey, you know, in a lot of situations, we are seeing a climate change signal. Now, this research is still relatively new, but it's coming along quite well. And I think in the future, we're going to get a lot better at it.
All right, Matt, next I'm throwing the ball to you. As we know, this June, President Trump announced the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Accord. Under the terms of the agreement, Trump can't actually withdraw until November 2020. But shortly after the president's announcement, mayors, governors, university presidents, business leaders, and investors across the country pledged to uphold the goals of the Paris Accord, and they signed an open letter called We Are Still In. First, I want to talk about what cities are doing, and Ann Arbor is one of the cities that pledged still try to reach those goals. What exactly is Ann Arbor planning to do?
Sure. Well, the good news is Ann Arbor's been working on this for a very long time with grad students from U of M. We did our first greenhouse gas inventory way back in 2003, developed a climate action plan, I think it was 2012, that basically set a 25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025, which mirrors perfectly the university's goals. We have separate plans, but we kind of work together on how it's going to happen. We've also set a 90% reduction by 2050. Not exactly sure how we're going to get there, but based on the science, that's what science has said we need to do by 2050 to reduce the amount of global warming. So that's what Ann Arbor's done. And then because we're part of this broad network of city sustainability directors, there's a lot of this work that's been going on in cities because cities are where we're feeling the flooding and we're seeing these increases. In Ann Arbor, we've measured a 44% increase in precipitation since 1950 and a 41% increase in the most extreme storms. Well, if we built a stormwater system to handle a certain size storm and those storms are changing, I've got to either build a bigger system or figure out how to do more retention of water on property or change the public's expectations that, hey, the climate's changed. There's going to be more flooding here.
What keeps you up at night the most when you think about trying to meet these goals?
For us, it's more on the energy side. We don't own a public utility, and so we don't have a solid pot of money like we do in solid waste and stormwater and other areas that Ann Arbor really excels at. So our ability to help residents, businesses with energy efficiency and work like that is an area we're not set up financially to do yet and haven't really built that partnership with DTE yet. But given DTE's recent commitment to 80% reduction by 2050, which is huge for a public utility, we're really looking forward to those opportunities.
Where are you right at this moment at meeting these goals that you've set?
So the good news is, if you look at 2000 to now, we've dropped our emissions community-wide by 18%. That's the good news. Part of that is DTE was required to have 10% renewable energy, and that's made up a big chunk of it. And then U of M bought the Pfizer site, so that pulled all of those emissions into the U of M pot, so I don't have to deal with them anymore. So we're hoping that U of M buying all the property is not our solution to meeting our climate goals. But and then, you know, there's been a lot of efficiency with LEDs and furnaces and things like that. So we're making real progress, and I think we're going to meet our 2025 goals. But without a real effort in both the transportation and heating section, where we're using a lot of natural gas, We're never going to meet our 2050 goals.
How much will this cost?
You know, that's hard to say. The technology's changing. One of the things that I share with people is, you know, we want energy efficiency for greenhouse gas reductions, but citywide, we spend $250 million on natural gas and electricity. And we can save 10% with caulk. So that's $25 million a year that would stay in the local economy. And we don't make a lot of coal or natural gas. So there's a lot of this that we ought to be doing just for purely local economic development reasons.
All right. Now, Andy, we saw some leaders of multinational corporations voice their opposition to the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Accord. General Electric, Apple, Tesla. What does the U.S. pulling out of the agreement mean for corporations?
Well, it really means uncertainty. Businesses, first of all, the question I get, you know, what does business think about X, is a really problematic question because business is really diverse. But if you think about climate change in business terms, think about it as a market shift. And there will be winners and there will be losers. And the losers are happy and the winners are not. It doesn't stop progress. It just creates more static and more uncertainty. Most companies that are impacted by climate change, either through energy use or through adaptation, see the market shift coming. They're just trying to time it so that they shift at the right time. And an international agreement isn't the only mechanism that's pushing them. Certainly state legislators, city governments, insurance companies, banks, suppliers, buyers, consumers, global markets. The U.S. may pull out. California's still in. The EU and the rest of the world is still in. Multinational corporations exist in global markets, and they don't like to make one product for one market and one product for another market. So they're really trying to navigate uncertain terrain and try and figure out what does the future hold.
So who are the standouts to you? Who's actually doing something?
Oh, I hate that question. I try and think about the companies that are making aggressive goals and trying to hit them. So, you know, Matt was talking about what Ann Arbor is trying to do. Toyota has announced they want to be carbon neutral by 2050 in manufacturing and use of their product. And as you know, Toyota is one of the leaders moving into hybrid and electric technologies. So that's, in fact, anyone in the auto sector, if you ask them, eventually we're going to be an electric mobility sector. And whether driverless cars displace personal ownership, that's another factor in this market shift before us. But the important thing about business in this whole conversation, to my mind, is that whether you like it or not, business is the most powerful institution on earth within the market. And so if business isn't solving this problem, it won't be solved. They build the buildings we live and work in, the clothes we wear, the food we eat, the cars we drive, the energy source that powers them. And so this market shift is building momentum. It's already happening in numerous sectors, and Trump can't stop that. He can't bring back coal, and he can't turn back the innovation curve on certain renewables.
What's the most important market shift that you see, not necessarily for a specific company, but in terms of, are we talking about renewable energy or something else like that?
Well, I think we're in the midst of an energy renaissance, and I use that word deliberately because the beauty of a renaissance is you never know you're in it till it's done. And if you were to project out 50 years from now, those cars out there are going to be fundamentally different. I feel very safe in saying that. And the way this building is powered is going to be fundamentally different as well. We're going to have distributed energy. We're going to have demand-side management. We're going to have all kinds of innovations where I personally think that in 50 years you'll look back and say, how did this happen?
And this is a question for both of you, or either of you. In the absence of federal leadership on climate change, how much can cities and corporations achieve?
Well, include state governments in there, too. I mean, California is an economy unto itself.
Right.
And the adage within business, particularly on environmental issues, is where California goes, so goes the country. I mean, they really led the charge on CAFE standards, fuel efficiency standards, and they don't, again, auto companies don't want to make a product for California, another one for the rest of the country. They want to make one product. Same with appliance manufacturers. Whirlpool wants to make one product. They don't want to make different products for different markets. So I think that states can have a tremendous impact on driving the market.
But you really need to have federal leadership to make the Paris goals work. It's not going to happen through voluntary measures. It's not going to happen by businesses alone and states alone and local governments alone. It has to be driven by international agreements and then implemented by the national leaders.
And Matt, do you want to add anything there?
I guess what I would add is, you know, the cities are, you know, they've been working on this for a long time, and if anything, they're doubling down with the pullout from Paris. So you've got cities like L.A., Seattle, Portland on the West Coast getting all the fleet data from all the cities across the U.S. and then sending a note to GM and Ford saying, here's a million vehicles that these cities own. We want to electrify our Ford F-250s, not just the Focuses. I need an electric plow. I need an electric garbage truck and bus, and kind of really sending that demand signal to the industry.
All right. I'd like to open it up for the questions that you all have. Lindsay has the microphone, so you can just raise your hand and she'll bring you the microphone. Please say your name and where you're from.
My name is Newt Nadelhofer, and I'm from Ann Arbor. I've actually just returned from Copenhagen from a six-month sabbatical. And one of the contrasts here, Ann Arbor is a great city, but I find it to be a dangerous city to bicycle in, and I'm wondering what the city's plans are to make bicycle transportation the default mode of transportation. Are there plans? Are there funds? Are there resources? I live 3 miles away, and I never bike because I have to go down Liberty, which is a poorly marked bike path with stones and grates. Anyway, what's the plan for bicycle friendliness?
Yeah, so we do have a non-motorized plan for the city. You can go on the website and look at it. As having been to Copenhagen and seen the difference, we are clearly not there yet and aren't resourcing it the way that Copenhagen is. You know, I'm not the expert on where we get all our non-motorized transportation funds. What I do know is there's been discussion with the new county millage that if a rebate were made available to the city, some of that would go to pedestrian safety, non-motorized work, some to affordable housing, some to actually working on our community climate, which could potentially support that too. So, you know, I think that's one of those things where you have to chat with your council members and, you know, really demonstrate that demand. You know, we've made a lot of progress in adding bike lanes, but we're nowhere near the separated bike lanes. And I don't know that we've made a real commitment that we are going to be bicycling being the predominant way to get someplace like it is in Copenhagen.
But, Newt, if I could pick up on that, and let's just do a little fun thought experiment of imagining a future with driverless cars. Let me begin by saying I suspect many of you may not like the idea of getting into a driverless car. I can assure you my students do. I do a little game with them at the beginning of class. I tell them I love cars, and I really do. I love classic cars. And they look at me like I have three heads. To them, a car is transportation, and it's an asset they do not want as a millstone around their neck. Now, right now, how many cars are idle in the fleet in this immediate area? Estimates are around 95% are idle. If we go to driverless cars, you call one up on your phone, and a driverless car will make money if it works like the airline sector. Airlines make money if that plane sits as short as time on the ground. It's flying all the time. Driverless car manufacturers or suppliers of mobility, will make money if those cars keep moving. If that happens, a lot of the fleet on the road goes away, a lot. If that happens, that parking lot is no longer necessary. Some of these roads are no longer necessary. That garage behind your house is not necessary. The gas station down the street starts to disappear, and a car becomes just a form of mobility that you borrow, and this is going to be a much friendlier bike city when that happens.
When I think one last thing is I wonder whether it's going to be safer with autonomous vehicles and bicyclists, that the smart cars will know better.
I don't think smart cars read their cell phone when they're driving. I must say.
I'm glad the bike issue has been brought up. That's my primary vehicle. I don't think the bike paths are progress. I'm sorry. I think they're really dangerous, and I don't use them because I find if I'm on the street with my bicycle, I get run over pretty quickly. So we need a better solution than that.
That stirred people up.
Hi, my name's Peter, and my question refers to Professor Hoffman. You had said that there would be winners and losers, and you said the winners wouldn't be happy?
No. Well, the winners wouldn't be happy that we pulled out of the Paris Accord. The losers will be. Those who lose in a carbon-constrained economy, coal, fossil fuels, are pleased that we pulled out of Paris. Those that win, renewable energy sector, are unhappy.
I'm Eric, and I live here in Ann Arbor, and I wonder in a future where instead of OPEC or oil being the commodity, it's water, and then who controls that, and how is it transported to other countries, and take from there. Thank you.
Yeah, it's... Hello? Did we lose you? Hello? I'll borrow yours.
It's already getting to be that way. There's a lot of battles between, particularly in the Middle Eastern countries, over water. Israel and their neighbors are having some major disputes, Iraq and its neighbors, and also China with their dams they're putting in Tibet. The downstream countries are not very happy. So, yes, absolutely, the water wars are going to be the wars of resource fought in the future as opposed to oil. I mean, it's been oil for so long, but I think water is going to be taking its place.
And if I can add a business element to that question, you know, as much as things change, they stay the same. You know, the old adage for the American West is whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. That will become more and more true. So, for example, Coca-Cola really has been caught flat-footed in the past years because they're finding that they have bottling plants in drought-prone regions. Now, there was a day when you never thought about that, and now it seems pretty stupid that they would do that. And they're starting to think of themselves more as a water company than a soft drink company because basically, they take water, add some secret sauce, carbonate it, and provide you a beverage. It's not that hard, except for the water. And in fact, 3 years ago, they did a study with the World Resources Institute. They did a global assessment, and they looked at supply and demand of water all over the world. And it really scared a lot of people, because if you do look at supply and demand, someone who's opportunistic, for example, someone who buys a drug company and jacks up a life-saving drug from $15 to $900 can do some pretty horrible things by taking advantage of places that have low supply and high demand. So it is something to be aware of and concerned about. That really brings up the question that has emerged in Detroit and elsewhere, is water a right? Or is it a commodity? And the CEO of Nestle really stepped in it when he gave a speech, picture a very Germanic guy giving a very dry speech saying that water is a commodity and people should have to pay for it. And Nestle really got hammered for it and he had to back way off. But it is a concern.
Well, my name's Curtis Pinnegy, and I live here in Ann Arbor, came out here from California. And I'm going to address the two issues just very briefly. One, I'm going to take a different stance. My complete source of travel primarily here in Ann Arbor is bicycle, okay? Lived here about 12 years, bicycle everywhere, pretty much 365 days a year. Yes, I even rode in the cold freeze a couple years ago. I have to give kudos to Ann Arbor because I came out here from another town, actually Westland in the Wayne area. And if you think it's bad here riding a bicycle, you try it there. I was hit in the 5 years I lived there 3 times by cars on my bicycle while I was in a crosswalk with the green light on my side because they didn't care. Okay, I was stopped 4 times by police just going to work and carded because their answer was, I said, why are you carding me? I have a clean driving record. Got a driver's license and a spotless record. I just don't own a car. They said, because you ride a bicycle and the only ones who ride bicycles are children and criminals. Okay, that's what I was told. So if you think it's bad here, this place is wonderland compared to a lot of the other cities out there. Okay. They can do more, I admit that, but it is still wonderland. So I want to give kudos to Ann Arbor on that. And the other point is on the drinking water. Water has always been a problem. In fact, what we're drinking here in this place was created because in the old days, plain water wasn't drinkable. It would kill you. So they developed fermentation and boiling of water and making alcohol so we could survive. So that's my point.
I'll just add one note on the water issues that I don't know Western water law, but, you know, all of a sudden I'm talking to colleagues in Boulder, and it turns out it's illegal for a homeowner to store stormwater in Boulder because that water is supposed to hit the ground, run to the Colorado River, and somebody else owns that. And until recently, I think there was a court case that allowed them to do this, but that's so different that the law is here. And that's a lot of what we're working on now is rather than getting that water directly to the street and into the river, how do we store it on site, in the parks, in other places, to keep it out of our, you know, like Allen Creek, which is basically a buried river.
If you want to read a good and entertaining book on Western water history and the politics around it, Cadillac Desert is a really, really interesting read.
Okay. Hi. We just moved from Los Angeles in Wisconsin to Pittsfield Township. And I'm interested in knowing if there's any incentive programs or grant programs for renewable energy, incorporating that into your home, for PV systems, for wind systems, for passive solar domestic hot water. You know, we're kind of only been here a couple months, so we're starting at the bottom, and we're not sure what's available here.
So the utility is the one. DTE is your primary natural gas electric supplier. They're the primary source of those rebates. Occasionally, there have been times when the state's been involved, but you know, Pittsfield Township doesn't have anything that they're going to offer you through the local government. Ann Arbor, occasionally we've had grants, but really not so much right now. So I think mostly you're looking at the utility. We're doing a lot of work trying to see whether there's opportunities where, you know, we're 33% canopied in Ann Arbor. A lot of houses can't put solar on the roof. So can we take our old landfill on the south side of town, cover that with solar, and sell you four panels that, especially even as a renter, because that's a challenge for us. Half of our households are rental. As you move from place to place, you can't just take that solar off the roof, but with community solar, there'd be an opportunity, those same four panels, you get that credit no matter what. That's in the future and I think coming.
Hello. So my question is, with the increase in electrified technologies and electronics, those technologies drive other impacts on the environment, not necessarily CO2 emissions, but in terms of mining heavy metals, et cetera. Can you speak to how that impact may or may not offset the damage done in CO2 emissions?
I mean, that's a great question because we really have to, you have to think about life cycle of a product and then think about the system. And it's extremely complex stuff. We do have a Center for Sustainable Systems that will look at simple questions like should you use disposable or cloth diapers, should you use a plastic or paper bag, that's actually not an easy question to answer, all the way to what are the ramifications of that cell phone and the heavy metals within it, did they come from the Democratic Republic of Congo, are they recycled, what is the energy demand that's created by those products, when does it enter the grid? That's an important question too, because ideally all these appliances are going to go onto the grid in the evening when demand is low. And if you know how a grid works, you have peaks in the afternoon, troughs in the evening. If you can level that demand curve, you can fill it with cheaper energy. So there's no simple answer to your question other than we have to start to think systemically about the solutions to these issues, and that needs coordination from things like the Paris Climate Accord.
Hi. I've always wondered if it wouldn't help Michigan's economy if instead of selling our water to Coke or Pepsi, if we would bottle it ourselves and sell it.
Yeah, I actually don't. I recall some conversation about the city looking into should we bottle the Huron River and sell it, given that the. Yeah, and I can't speak to broader Great Lakes. So how many of you know where your water comes from? 85% is the Huron River, about 15% from wells on the south side of town. We used to have another well. We don't yet use it anymore. And the good news is for us, historically, there's only been one day in the last 80 years when we couldn't have pulled our total demand out. And what's interesting is we've changed the way we price water. We charge you more the more you use. It's called an inclining block rate structure. And the interesting thing is we're selling less water than we've ever sold before. So we don't have a water conservation program. We've just priced it right. And, you know, so we're using a lot less water to the point where if you guys start using less, we're going to have to raise your rates. So keep using right about where you are.
All right, next question.
I have a question about unanticipated costs or effects of some of these technologies, specifically about driverless cars. It mentioned that driverless cars might, the advent of that might coincide with a downswing in private car, saying that's unlikely to be the case immediately. So is it the case that driverless cars are likely to encourage people to move out of cities, to extend the commute time of people and thereby offsetting any kind of benefits that come along with these kinds of cars?
That is a common concern and a common question. If you make your house more energy efficient, will you be less concerned about turning the lights off at night? So unintended consequences of the introduction of a technology is exactly that, unintended and hard to predict. But people are trying to do it. And certainly there will be people that may choose to live far away and sleep on their way into work if they can don't have to drive that or wherever. That certainly will happen. Whether that will be the majority, it's hard to say. And what will be the aggregate impact, we're just going to have to watch. But that's what anyone who introduces a new technology, they try and watch and see how it works. I remember one time having a conversation about 10 years ago, and it was a bunch of auto execs, and hybrids were fairly new. And Toyota was selling the Prius. They were pretty much the only one on the market, and they were losing about $10,000 a car. And one of the execs said, "They're idiots. What a stupid idea." And the other exec said, "No, they're brilliant, because they are getting every one of those cars back. They are analyzing them in real-time use. What's that data worth?" And he just paused and goes, "It's priceless." And so they're trying to understand the application of the technology, and that's very hard to predict because humans are human.
And if you could say your name and where you're from.
Sure. Marianne James from Ann Arbor. What do you think about taxing carbon emissions with the fees collected going back to the citizens as dividends?
That's probably the best scheme we have out there as far as raising revenues and, you know, causing the 2-degree centigrade limit to be reached. I mean, yeah, that's called cap and dividend. Cap and trade is kind of a different sort of animal. That's one that the businesses were more in favor of because they could make a profit on it. But cap and dividend, I think that's the way to go, and I would like to see more serious discussion of it.
Barry Rabe at the Ford School does surveys of public opinion on certain issues around climate change, and he found that if you ask people, are you for a carbon price, you get a certain response. If you say we're going to give a dividend back to the public, because that's always left out of the equation. Let's do a cap and trade or let's do a carbon tax. Well, where does the money go? Does it buy more tanks and jets and weapons, or does it go to the public? That gets a much higher favorable response. I would also add that if you want to bring conservative Republicans under the tent, you start to float this idea as well, not necessarily giving it back to the public, but reduce taxes elsewhere, such as a business tax. And now you can start to get some Republicans behind it saying, yeah, as long as it's revenue neutral and benefits business, I'm all for it.
Yeah, again, it's like our water rates. You price it right and you can get the needle to move in the right direction. You know, I think the key thing is making sure the poor folks are taken care of, that, you know, if there's a way to keep that burden low.
Hi, I'm Dan from New Hampshire, and I think this is a great event. What I'm wondering is, how do we increase the knowledge and the commercial possibility of spreading the word about environmental issues? It seems to be more of an organic issue amongst, you know, communities and all that. How do we spread that on more of a commercialized aspect? That's what I want to see, is I want to see it more widespread amongst people who aren't aware.
I have some thoughts on that. I've done a lot of work looking at why people reject the science of climate change, and I'm quite fascinated by that. And the underlying reasons why, when you say environmental issues, people in this crowd hear one thing. If we went to a more conservative town, they're going to hear something far different. And understanding the subtext is critically important. But I also think that something important happened in November. You may know about this. And I think it's changed the public discourse in an interesting way. And let's see how it plays out. But the Yale Center on Climate Communication surveys the American public every year on their positions on climate change. There's one question I always find fascinating. Do you talk about climate change with family or friends? The answer is only 1 in 3 do. 2 in 3 think it's impolite. It's like sex, politics, and religion. You don't talk about it in polite company. I think since November, and increasingly so, people are starting to say, screw that. I'm going to start to speak up. You want to say climate change is not real? I'm going to actually disagree with you because I think you're wrong. And I think that, you know, I try and look at the silver lining of things, and I think the sort of the corrupted discourse around climate change is actually forcing people to come out of the closet, so to speak, and say, you know what? It's real. I think it's real, and I'm not going to let your bullshit stand.
Well, jumping on that, Andy, too, with the what are the polling numbers saying in terms of Americans' belief in the science of climate change over the last, since 2008 when we saw a peak?
Well, right now about 2/3 of Americans think it's real. Democrats outnumber Republicans. Democrats are up around 90%. Republicans just cleared around 50%. And the numbers are trending up. And when you ask people why, their answer is the weird weather. They need that personal interaction with it. I can't see CO2. I can't feel global mean temperature. But I can see droughts, wildfires, hurricanes, tornadoes. And that gets people to say, something strange is going on here. And especially if you talk to people who make their living off the land. Yeah. Talk to a farmer and say, do you see climate change? And they'll look at you like, are you kidding me? Of course I do. Anyone who needs water, whether it's a power plant or a beverage manufacturer, they see it as well. So anyone connected to the physical reality of it, their conversation's over.
The big problem we have is the amount of money being spent by PR firms at the behest of the fossil fuel industry to cast doubt upon the science of climate change. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, I mean, there's a lot of businesses and so on that are impacted by climate change who fund a limited amount of PR efforts to, you know, try and reverse that tide, but it's like more than 10 to 1. I mean, the Sierra Club, sure, they got a little bit of a budget to do PR efforts, but it's drowned out by this massive sea of money that goes to elect politicians, that goes to write op-eds in, you know, prominent newspapers. Really, the deck is tremendously stacked against us. Just having the science isn't enough. We need a PR firm for the environment to go out there and battle, you know, the tide of money with money of its own. I mean, yeah, we're making some headway, but I talk all the time with my colleagues about, you know, the science of social scientists about understanding this whole issue. And it comes down to money. It's going to be very difficult to turn the tide. Eventually we will, because the science is on our side. But it's difficult. I mean, right now you hear politicians acknowledge that, okay, right, climate change is happening, but are humans responsible? I don't believe so. Well, that's BS. The science has shown very clearly that 100% of global warming, that's the best estimate, is due to humans. 100%, maybe a little more even. We might be sliding towards an ice age now if it weren't for human-caused climate change. So 97% of scientists agree that human-caused climate change is real and the dominant responsibility lies with humans.
I'm gonna offer, I don't disagree, money has polluted this conversation. But in the words of Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. And someone would be swayed by you sitting down over a beer and saying, you know, I've heard you talk about climate change this way, and I just want to explain to you why you think you're wrong. And do it in a way that's polite, that's respectful, and you can start to turn heads. I do believe that there can be a grassroots social movement to say, you know what, I believe in science, and I'm not going to let you say things that aren't true.
Let me just add on the local side, A2CP, Ann Arbor Climate Partnership, is the Ecology Center Watershed Council. There's a local grassroots group, so if you're interested in getting involved, Google Ann Arbor Climate Partnership. The other thing is there's a whole group of people that would be happy to come out to your place of worship, club, whatever group. You can feel free to contact me directly. I'm easy to find on the internet. But there's a speakers group that's starting with the Ann Arbor Climate Partnership. So, again, if you think there's a way that you can get, even if it's a dozen people in your living room, we can get somebody out there to share our local story and some of the things you can do, boots on the ground locally.
Okay, Lindsay, next question.
Hi, I'm Bob from Cleveland, Ohio, and yes, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame city. What is the temperature? Why is that a partisan issue? Why is the temperature of the ocean? Why is the temperature of the land? Why is the temperature, period, a partisan issue?
It's a partisan issue because it interferes with the profits of the richest and most powerful industry in the history of the world, the fossil fuel industry. And if they cast doubt upon that, then their profits are protected. They look at it as a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders to protect profits. They have to do everything they legally can to keep the value of the company. And if the idea that, you know, their product is dangerous gets out there, they need to fight against it.
And if I can keep on going, there's a whole host of reasons, again, understanding the subtext. Who are the primary spokesmen on climate change? Well, it's scientists, Democratic politicians, and environmentalists. And there's people in this country that distrust one, two, or all three of those groups. There are people who don't believe climate change is real because it will create more government, bigger government, control in the market. We don't want that. Some people here may think that the market needs government to restrain it. There are other people who think that government is an intrusion in the market and an unwanted one. There are people who think that climate change challenges the notion of God. God promised, don't laugh, God promised Noah he would never flood the earth again. Don't laugh, because I've been heckled on this one. And if you get to that level, you realize the emotion that can come to this debate. If you're challenging someone's belief in God, who says, we're not that important, God's in charge out there, who are you to think that we're that consequential that we can alter the climate? If you're at that level, you're in very tricky territory if you're going to try and convince someone that this is real.
Yeah, those are great points, especially the one about the ideology of, you know, big government. The only way we're going to solve the climate crisis is with international big government, and that's really scary to a lot of conservatives.
Jeff, let me ask you this. So when we have warmer winters, and people look outside their window, right? And so weather is how we think about climate most of the time. So when we have a cold winter, how do you suggest communicating that to people who don't believe climate change is real?
Yeah, that's a toughie, because polling shows that people's opinions on climate change with the weather. If it's particularly hot out, they say, oh, I believe in climate change. And if it's a cold winter, they say, oh, so much for climate change. But you can maybe counter that a little bit and say, well, you know, the Earth is tilted on its axis. We still have winter. That's the way I do it.
I'm just going to make an editorial comment. I really feel uncomfortable when we're on panels about the environment and we're fed bottled water, just for the record.
Although you can recycle it here.
Yeah. All right, next question, Lindsay.
Hi, I'm Rose from Brighton. I like this conversation because one of the questions that I have for people who are denying climate change is, what's the downside to need to do things to help the environment? I'm glad that you're saying.
And on the local level, I mean, one of the things I found, especially, it's been a great thing to be able to talk to people in Portland, but also Columbia, Missouri, Lawrence, Kansas. Those are cities a lot like us, very different politics. A bunch of them can't use the word climate change. But what you find as you start looking at these, okay, what are the projects that cities are undertaking? They all have these co-benefits. You know, nobody is doing anything for just one reason anymore. And so, like I made the argument, this energy efficiency for us is economic development. It makes it cheap. We don't make coal or natural gas here. So the money that you spend on a local electrician, insulation, to get that work done in your house, that money spins in this local economy so much longer than the check you write to a utility company to buy coal in Montana. So I think these are the things that we're starting to tease out as we look at these projects. And this is where you get to, yeah, we ought to be doing this no matter what, whether you care about carbon or not.
I'm reminded of a political cartoon where someone is at a rally and says, boy, what if we create a better world and offer nothing? But I think you also have to recognize that the impacts are not, they're not evenly distributed, and some people are going to pay a price. I mean, coal miners are going to are losing their jobs for a whole host of reasons besides climate change. And so it's not a universal free good. There will be differential costs. Some people will be hurt. And I think it's important to recognize that. Some people are genuinely concerned about their livelihood and moving on environmental issues. Sometimes it's a canard that it costs jobs, but sometimes it's true.
A big thing to consider going forward is the stranded assets. I'm sure you're familiar with that. There are over $1 trillion worth of fossil fuels in the ground we cannot pull up, or it will literally fry the earth. And when it comes time to it, at some point, the oil industry is going to see a major crash, which is going to impact the economy in a big way, unless they diversify.
Next.
Hi, my name is Brian Sergine. I live in Ann Arbor. So we've talked about the shift to renewable energies and the technologies that would be involved in that, more batteries, new battery technology, lithium, supercapacitors, stuff like that. I'm curious, how much of these resources do we have if everyone is switching to solar panels and batteries? And how palatable is it to talk about using less energy, less resource?
I mean, if you really want to get down to the root of it, the issue here is consumption and overpopulation. And that second one in particular is a third rail. I mean, it's really provocative to talk about that. But if you really want to get to the roots of the issue, that has to be part of it. But we as human beings would much rather have a technological silver bullet that allows us to continue our life as we live it. If you can get me an electric Hummer, I'm going to feel good about driving that Hummer, and I don't have to change a thing in my lifestyle. So that, as we pass 7 billion headed towards 9 billion, resource availability and the pricing that goes with it. We've already talked about water. Water is going to become costly. All these cell phones you have are relying on lithium. Where is that lithium going to come from? There's all kinds of resource issues that the market's going to start to adjust and price accordingly. And will that make certain products available only to the rich who continue to consume more while the middle class and poor people less? Now we're really getting into some hot water.
Hi, my name is Brendan. I'm from Canton, Michigan. And my question was about, so we talked a lot about winners and losers, and I was wondering if you guys had some comments about winners from climate change. And this is about something that I heard on NPR, of course. But it was about Russia and the idea that, you know, with warming climate, they're actually going to see a lot of benefit to their agriculture and other industries, and like having warm water access, things like that. And I was wondering if you're seeing anything similar to that in the United States, where people are seeing that, like, okay, climate change is real and we're not really optimistic about being able to mitigate it or reverse the trends. So, you know, let's just bank on the fact that there's going to be rising sea levels. You know, how do we adapt to that instead of necessarily trying to combat climate change?
So let's take the winners question, right? It sounds like your question is, who are the winners in the United States? Is that right?
Okay. Well, I'm looking at Don Zak right here, and I'm sorry I'm going to cold call you Don, but Don is someone who studies the impact of increased CO2 on agriculture and he'd be much more authoritative to talk about that than I. Can you field that question, John?
It's not an easy question to answer, Andy, because climate change is multifaceted. It's not just CO2, it's temperature, it's drought, and all of those things combine to interact. And in today's scientific world, we've been able to do single factor experiments. What happens when CO2 goes up? That only gets us so far. It might be totally counteracted by changes in precipitation, by changes in temperature. So we've not been able to do the kind of experiment that we really need to be able to do to prognosticate what the future holds for agriculture and for forestry and food, fiber, and forage production.
Do we have a sense, though, following up on that, about within agriculture, some crops may do better, some may not do as well? Can we answer that question yet?
I don't think we can. And it's a complicated issue. You know, there's these environmental changes that occur at a particular place, but climate's going to change and people adapt. There's vineyards in France and the Pacific Northwest and in California that are buying land northward and anticipating where that new climate's going to be, where it's the sweet spot for growing grapes. So we have that going on, adaptation, along with scientific uncertainty in how plants will respond to these kinds of global changes. I was raising my hand, and I'd like to make a different point. So at many points in our conversation today, I've heard, do you believe in climate change, or do people believe in climate change? And I think we can go a long way by dispelling that climate change is a belief system. In my mind, saying, do you believe in climate change is equivalent to saying, do you believe in math? It's a set of scientific facts, and I don't think we'd get very far if Bank of America said, sorry, you know, you're $2,000 in the hole, and your response is, yeah, but I don't believe in math. So I think the media can do a great service by stop talking about belief systems and talking about facts and science.
But I have a response to that, because I think it is a question, do you believe in science? I think that is a fair question, and there are people in this country who don't believe in science. They don't understand it, or they don't believe it, or they don't trust it, and it's not a new phenomenon. The book that won the Pulitzer Prize in 1964, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, wrote all about this. They don't trust us.
I'd go back to, do you trust math? Does 1 plus 1 equal 2? The same thing. I think that could appeal to those same people.
All right, next question.
Hi, I'm Joe from Toledo. Andrew Hoffman, I think he's at Stanford, wrote a book, How Culture Affects Climate Change Debate.
No, he's at University of Michigan.
University of Michigan? I thought you? Oh, so you know about this, right? Oh, we got to talk afterwards. I read your book.
He's my press agent.
Oh, no kidding. So, yeah, you know about this then, right? So isn't it some people are talking about economic issues, like climate skeptics are talking about economic issues, climate change. You call that, believers talking about... They're just talking past each other?
Yeah.
Oh, that's Andrew Hoffman.
Did you pay him?
Yeah. You got signed copies ready for us?
Hi, I'm Mary Delkamp from Ypsilanti, Michigan, and I went and saw here at our Michigan Theater last week or 2 weeks ago the Inconvenient sequel, and I came home all excited, and I have two millennials living with us that are artists, musicians, and he said, I'm cool with that, but everybody wonders about the beef, Is that on your radar? Does it matter? Apparently it's a big issue among millennials, that beef, and I went out west, and those little doggies are everywhere. I saw the ones in the mud lot. I saw them everywhere. I drove across the United States, way to Utah, southwestern Utah, and saw little doggies all over our land and all those cattle gates. And I saw the Colorado River. And, you know, I wonder about this beef issue.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to change your lifestyle in a way that benefits greenhouse gas emissions, become a vegetarian. I've been one 25 years. And I read that, you know, if we eliminate beef from our diet and replace it with beans, that's going to meet our Paris Climate Accord agreements goals. So, yeah, it's hugely wasteful to be eating beef.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the role of local government to tell you what to eat, but they already argue about idling and things like that. You know, I think the role for us is 40% of the trash you throw out is food. And so how do we get you an opportunity to compost that? And for residents in Ann Arbor, you can put all of your food waste into your brown compost card. And if you're a renter in Ann Arbor and you look like a single-family house, you can get a compost cart from your landlord and put every bit of organics you have in that, and we will take it. Currently only April through December, but we're working on making that year-round. And even if we don't, it's winter time, it'll freeze, and it won't stink. So just keep doing it year-round anyway. So.
All right, next question.
Hi, my name is Michelle Wilkins-Bailey. I'm an Ann Arbor teacher, and I live in Ann Arbor. I was wondering, I'd like to hear from each of you what you think is, well, let me say this. Not all of us are willing to be out there as activists. And those of us who are not, what would you say are the biggest things that we can do as individuals to make a difference in climate change?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll just start on the energy side. We have a website, a2energy.org. We tell you to insulate and air seal your house. Once you've done that, come back to us and we'll tell you other things to do. Because literally, 10% with caulk is an easy saving. So that's just money you're, you know, pouring out the windows. So that's the simple thing on the energy side that we would say.
I'd say get informed. Understand the science. Understand the politics, the communication of the science issues. And, yeah, you can change what you do personally, drive a better car and so on. But really a political solution is ultimately what is required to solve this crisis. And getting active in politics to elect people who are, you know, going to do the right thing is of fundamental importance.
And just picking back on these two, voting, I think, is probably one of the most important things you can do. But to pick on Matt's point, educate yourself, live a lifestyle that's authentic to what you believe, and then educate those around you. Model the behavior you want to be.
Okay, Lindsay?
Hi, so Austin here in Ann Arbor. So I work for a software company called Llamasoft a few blocks down, and we do supply chain modeling for big companies. So for me, we talk about business driving a lot of the change here, and what we see with our customers, they have the ability to model cap and trade or track CO2, and pretty much none of them are doing it. They don't have the incentive. So mainly what I see with our usage is that they are trying to be more efficient, and they save money, and then, by the way, they might say they saved X amount in CO2. So I think that's the trend that we've seen. So I guess the question for you guys is, in 3.5 years, maybe less, what changes? Where are the climate accords at that point? What's the future?
Get my crystal. Yeah.
I think for the duration of this administration, don't expect a heck of a lot out of Washington. And I talk to people in companies, and they're in this pregnant pause, but they've been in one for a while. If you go back to the Clinton administration with Al Gore as vice president, companies were starting to ramp up and expect this. Swiss Re started a carbon trading desk anticipating this, and then they didn't anticipate George W. Bush. And that threw everything backwards. Obama came in and really did not light up the issue as much as people expected. And so companies right now on this issue, they're doing voluntary steps because they think eventually it's going to have to happen. But they're also preparing to ramp up when they need to. And absent a really clear signal from government, companies are going to be very varied in their response, some more than others.
And I think there's going to be an opportunity for demand side. You know, people are going to want that disclosure. You know, I don't think I would have anticipated 10 years ago, I go into my grocery store and it says how many miles this apple traveled to get to. And now maybe that's just Ann Arbor, but I think, again, if 150 cities across the U.S. say, yeah, we're not buying vehicles unless you give a full carbon disclosure of the life cycle cost of that vehicle, that whole supply chain tool that you've created, you're going to be right there and ready. You know, it's the abilities there. The demand for that information isn't.
All right, next question, please.
Hi, my name is Jenny, and I'm from Ann Arbor. I'm wondering if you've heard of the prominent Republicans that came out this year and formed the Climate Leadership Council, and they proposed a plan for pricing carbon with turning all the revenue to households. And according to analysis they released by the Treasury Department, it showed that 70% of households would come out ahead under that plan. And so I'm wondering, what do you think the impact of these prominent Republicans speaking out for federal legislation right now is?
Are you talking about this thing that James Baker did?
Yes.
One of the rubs there is that they're not sitting politicians. They're past politicians, and that's problematic. They're not as relevant, and they were quickly dismissed by mainstream Republicans as rhinos. Now, I want to see more sitting politicians, and there is a caucus.
20 or so.
Yeah, there's a caucus, and they're trying to keep it balanced, Democrats and Republicans, of politicians in office, saying we've got to do something about this. And they are framing it on this message that we believe in science. And I think that's the right framing. Don't climate change by itself, but this is a scientific issue. I trust science. I'd still hang by that. I believe in science, because there are people who don't. We have a vice president who thinks the world was formed 5,000 years ago. There are some people who don't believe in science, and I think that's fair to say.
Next question, please.
This question concerns water and the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes go through about a 20-year cycle where they'll be dredging harbors, and 20 years later they'll have docks underwater because of too much water. And I don't know if this is continuing with the climate change, but the question is, here we are living in this bubble of fresh water unlike anywhere else on Earth. And how do we balance that supply and demand when we actually may find ourselves with too much water at some time and then not enough water at other times?
Jeff, you want to take that?
Yeah. One thing we do expect is that the extremes are going to get more extreme with respect to Great Lakes water levels. The record highs that we saw, for instance, on Lake Ontario this year, that's just the beginning. When we have really, really wet years, that's going to cause even greater flooding, and we do expect an increase in both the extremest wettest years and then the driest years as well. So the problem's only going to grow, and I haven't talked at all about how to address it, and I really don't know. It's going to take a lot of planning and forethought to be able to deal with this.
It is true we are blessed with lots of water. Climate change will increase algae blooms, which threatens that water. And then, I don't know if you remember this, but we remember when Bill Richardson was running for president, and one of the debates, he said, you know, down here in the Southwest, we need water. And up there in the Great Lakes, they have that water. Why don't we run a pipeline from one to the other? Yeah. And the great cry that came out of this area. Can you imagine running a pipeline to Arizona to feed those golf courses from Great Lakes water? I think people would really go apoplectic.
Okay, next question.
Hi, my name is Eric Kendig, and I'm from Saline. A lot of folks seem to think that sea level rise of 3 to 12 or 18 feet, depending on who you listen to, and some places being warmer, too hot, some places that are cold now, getting perhaps a little more pleasant. But there are far more dire consequences that have been identified by science that hold the promise for things that we would never want to even contemplate. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, we call that the fat tail of the probability distribution. When you hear naysayers talk about the projected climate change in the future, they're always talking about kind of the low end of what we call climate sensitivity. Okay, if we double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, how much does the climate warm? Well, the thought is it's somewhere between 1.5 degrees and 4 degrees centigrade. Okay, so we're planning for that range. But there is like a 5% chance that
we're going to see an 8-degree or maybe even 10-degree centigrade warmer world if we do that. And that's the really scary part. And, yeah, we should be talking about that high-risk, low-probability sort of event because it could come true.
I would add that it's preposterous to think that we're going to have these elevated temperatures that are going to turn, you know, Ann Arbor into a tropical paradise, and then it's just going to stop right where we want it. And it's not going to keep on going, and it's not going to come up with the associated issues of vector-borne diseases, increased pests, species die-off. If you really want to read a chilling article, it's very provocative, but the New York Magazine had an article, a cover story, The Doomed Earth Catalog, I think 3 weeks ago, scary as hell, and got a lot of flack for it, saying, why are you scaring people? But they said, we have to lay out the worst-case scenario so people understand this end of the tale that Matt is talking about.
Well, we're already in a mass extinction event. I mean, we're looking at probably a 50% loss of biodiversity in our lifetimes. So it'll get even worse as the climate warms.
Okay, Lindsay?
I was interested in one of the themes for tonight's discussion in terms of the impacts of withdrawing from the Paris Peace Agreement. And our discussion was sort of, I mean, we talked about how businesses are on a trajectory and therefore might not have too much of an impact. But I was wondering whether you could say something about what you think the symbolic impacts would be. Because it took a lot to get a lot of people to buy in, and some is dropped, and something, whether there might be extensive international impacts beyond what happening within this country.
Well, Turkey has already pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement in response to Trump doing so, saying, hey, well, if the U.S. can do it, then we're not going to bother to do that anyway. But I think it's going to strengthen other people's resolve because they see that leadership is needed, and this is the way of the future, and the people who lead now are going to reap the benefits in the future, both morally and economically.
Do you want to add to that, Andy?
I'm stepping outside my area of expertise, and all I'll offer is editorial opinion that it damages our credibility. An agreement was made to simply say we changed our mind. That's just not going to fly in future negotiations, and I think that the U.S. government has marginalized itself by doing this. Now, that's my editorial opinion, you can guess what I think of the present administration. I will add, though, that if you want to think about the business implications of this, you know, where is the future going in mobility? Electrics. Who is investing in electrics? Germany. China. Where is renewables going? Photovoltaics. Wind. Geothermal. Who's investing in that? China. If they develop those technologies, we're going to buy those technologies from them. And this is part of the ways you can start to communicate climate change to people who aren't really open to the messages of science, to say, okay, let's look at it as an economic issue. Either we're going to develop the technology as someone else is. We can look at it as a national security issue. There will be climate upheaval. We're going to have to deal with that. You can look at it as a health issue. And The Lancet calls it the number one health risk of the coming century. And if you have elevated temperatures in urban centers, the vulnerable get hurt first and hardest. They're called your grandparents and your children and grandchildren. Now you've really made it personal. And now you can start to get some traction with people who may say, I'm not so sure about the science, but that one you just gave me really concerns me.
Okay, next question.
Hi, I should caveat my remarks first that I'm a federal employee working in the EPA, in the lab that regulates greenhouse gases, and I'm not speaking on a professional level at all. This is entirely a personal question. I'm actually going to avoid politics because this is a question about culture. The U.S. entered into Paris in a way that didn't require the approval of the Senate, largely because of the partisan nature of how this has become a partisan issue. I am a Roman Catholic, and I have come up with a sort of voter rule for single-issue voters. There's no such thing as global warming because abortion. And we're not going to sort of get past this partisan issue without a way to sort of breach that gulf. And I'm wondering, have you guys thought about ways to change the culture, way to build relationships outside of everybody get together and vote, everybody, you know, focus on Washington? Are there interventions that local governments, individuals, that states can do that are that are going to have a high degree of leverage and a high degree of impact, given the fact that the politics in this on a national level are so fraught and so difficult?
It is culture change. It is really changing how we think about the world around us and our place within it. You're a Roman Catholic. I think the Pope's encyclical was an important message from an important messenger. And I think that's an important dimension for bridging communities that aren't open to the message, is find a broker, find a messenger that they respect. I want to hear evangelicals hear from evangelicals that they trust. I want business people to hear from business people they trust. I want farmers in the middle of Michigan to hear from the farmer down the road or in the local Kiwanis Club or in the town hall. There's a way to start to bridge the gulf between us and start to break down this connection between a conservative ideology and disbelief in climate change, because the ordering has gotten flopped, where it used to be, these are the issues I care about, and now I'll categorize myself. And there were such things as conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. There were these gray zones. Now it's flopped. Choose a side. I'm red or I'm blue. Here's your suite of issues. Live them, learn them, love them. And that's insanity, because we're much more complex people than that. And I don't know how to break that down, especially as social media builds it up.
Want to weigh in on that, too?
On the culture side, you know, I think as a local government, I mean, what we can do is you actually have, those of you in Ann Arbor who pay Ann Arbor taxes, have an energy person who pays attention to this, does analysis. We have a good partnership with the university. Doing that work, sharing it with you, I think that's helpful. I would say on the culture side, for those of you that do have evangelical Christians in your family that may not be on board, Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist in Texas, married to an evangelical preacher, and I've seen her speak. She's fabulous, and you can find lots of her stuff on the internet. So again, I would just recommend send your family members to Catherine Hayhoe. I have some family members that learn about climate change in church, so it's like I've had to deal with this a little bit.
And if I could add, I think one way to go here, and it applies to all the issues that divide us right now that have become so toxic. If you read the New York Times, start reading Fox News. Start reading another viewpoint, not necessarily adopt it, but try and understand where people are coming from. And approach them with a little bit of compassion and a little bit of respect, and it will go a long way, because I think the ultimate issue here is an issue of trust. And people are trying to figure out why they shouldn't trust you before they hear what you talk about. Oh, you work for the EPA. I don't trust you already. You're an academic. I don't trust you either. So anything you say, I'm not going to believe you. So we're debating your motives before we even hear your ideas, and somehow we have to undo that. And part of the way to do that is to try and understand where other people are coming from. And maybe their concerns are real, and you can start to approach it from that viewpoint.
All right, next question.
Hi, I'm Patrick from Ann Arbor. I wanted to follow up on what Andy briefly mentioned about that bipartisan climate solutions caucus. And so the way that works is that, you know, for every Democrat, you must bring a Republican with you. So there's currently, I think, 26 Democrats and 26 Republicans all working on practical climate solutions. So I guess for Andy, I think my question is, what do you think that has the power to, the fact that there are 26 Republicans in the House that are actively working with Democrats to implement climate solutions, could that itself be a top-down way to kind of change how the debate is among conservatives and Republicans?
There are two things in your sentence that weren't true 2 years ago. Democrats and Republicans working together, and Republicans who think that climate change is real. And the reality is, if you go to Washington and you get behind closed doors, there's plenty of Republican congressmen, senators, and staffers who know this is real. They're just afraid to come out because they're afraid their constituency is going to hammer them. Bob Inglis stands as a cautionary tale for anyone who wants to stick their head above the water and say that climate change is real. They're afraid they're going to get voted out of office. And this issue, let's face it, when it comes to the issues that matter to voters, climate change is not at the top of the list. And so why stick your head out on an issue that's only going to hurt you and maybe not help you? And so I do believe that there can become a tipping point, a threshold, at which it's no longer dangerous to come out and say this is real. I actually personally believe it's true now. I believe that if tomorrow Donald Trump came out and said, you know what, I just talked to my national science advisor, and he's convinced me this is real. Let's get on with it. I actually don't think he'll get hammered. I really don't. And I think that it just takes someone with the courage to do it, and then another build on it, and off we go. And we've seen it in the corporate sector, too. Corporate executives who are afraid to come out on climate change, corporate executives who are afraid to buck Donald Trump. If you've been reading the news over the past couple of days, that the wheels on that train are starting to come off as well. So safety in numbers is a key here.
Just a point of fact, Andy, Donald Trump does not have a science degree. He doesn't.
No, fair enough.
We're to your right. Rebecca, you're right.
Where are you? Okay. Yes, next.
I guess mine's more of a quick summary for both my colleagues here. As a product of the University of Maryland, I think what I'm hearing coming into the heart of Ann Arbor is go green.
This is Casey from Ypsilanti again. So you spoke earlier about, at the core of it, overpopulation and overconsumption is the biggest cause of why we are where we are. You also spoke to the fact that one of the major things you can do, even if you aren't an advocate, is to get educated on the issues and how things that you do are impacting the Earth. So my question is, many people in this consumer-driven economy have a cycle life of their products, that even if the car or appliance is working perfectly fine, they will say that, well, I just want a new one. Is there anything that's being developed to be able to show them that if you go buy a new one versus wait out the life of the product that you already have, what the impact will be of, like, just creating that new appliance for the sake of just having a new one, rather than saving on the economic impact that could bring?
Go ahead. Yeah, go for it.
I don't know of anything off the top of my head, but I'm willing to bet that if you Googled what is the environmental impact of an iPhone, it's not going to be too hard to find. And, you know, you can make a conscious choice to live your lifestyle where you're going to wear things out. I mean, I have a cell phone that Verizon wants me to replace, and it works just fine for me, so I'm not going to replace it. But certainly that's part of our consumer's culture, whether it's fashion or whether it's, you know, the phone is fashion now. It is. We are sent steady messages to consume and consume more. There have been groups that have tried to put labels on products for their environmental impact. Green Seals, what are some of the others? WWF had one.
Oh, Energy Star.
Energy Star is a big one.
Energy Star, right.
Yeah. To give you a funny example of the way humans behave, though, when Whirlpool first introduced front-loading washers, which are very energy efficient, people were freaked out at first. And then they saw the Energy Star label, and they actually made a conscious choice saying, wait a minute, it uses less water and less energy. It must not clean so well. And stop buying them. And they actually considered taking the Energy Star label off. And instead, they worked with Consumer Reports to add energy efficiency to their review of appliances. They worked with Lowe's and Sears and Home Depot on how to sell them. They worked with detergent makers to make better detergents that work in them. They decided to change behavior, which is what marketing's all about anyway, in a direction that we actually might like.
The one thing I can add on the city side is this idea of consumption is... A lot of cities are starting to pay attention to this. Eugene, Oregon's been doing a lot. By the way, Eugene, Oregon actually wrote their climate goals into code. So by law, Eugene has to meet their climate goals. But the other thing they're doing is starting repair stations. So where do you get retired volunteers, engineers, and is that the role of local government to kind of create these spaces so that when you have a broken toaster, you can bring it in, or a broken iPhone, come in, and somebody helps you actually repair it.
But I want to stress the cultural implications of what we're talking about here. This is really dangerous territory. I mean, how many of you have read the Gareth Hardin article, Tragedy of the Commons? Okay. How many have read it to the end? Because at the end, he advocates for legal controls on the right to procreate. You know, talk about scaring the shit out of people. And then, are you really going to have the city of Ann Arbor telling people what they cannot consume and whether they can or cannot get a new iPhone? Good luck. That's really dangerous territory in our culture. I don't know how we get past it, except I think the role of religion is huge here. And I think if people hear this as consistent with their religious values in the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temple, now we got something. But coming from government, that scares me. That really scares me.
And I wasn't telling people what to buy, just how to fix their toaster.
I mean, really, you can look at the climate crisis as a spiritual issue, a spiritual crisis. It's our overconsumptive lifestyle that's fundamentally to blame for where we're at. And if we're just happy with what we have, that's going to solve it. If we can all be, you know, just happy with a little bit, we don't need to have everything.
We have time for two more questions.
Andrew, you had mentioned about the market driving so much of this and how business has to go along. How are we as consumers to send the message that we want products that lower emissions? I understand people say you need to do it with your dollars. There are literally countless things I don't buy every day. I don't think I'm sending a message. I'm just cheap. So I'm curious. I've started taking to calling senators on political issues. I mean, should we directly reach out to business and express our preferences? What do you recommend?
The answer is a very strong yes. Companies are very sensitive to what people think about them. And they actually employ data mining companies right now to look for certain strings, like Coca-Cola sucks. They're going to try and find the seeds of that conversation so they don't suddenly get blindsided by a full-scale movement that they can't control. They are sensitive to what people say and think and do. And, you know, you're our one iPhone video away from a PR nightmare if you're a corporate executive. You know, just witness what happened with United Airlines. And in this world of social media, the power of one person is really amplified. I mean, one person was able to start a campaign to stop Bank of America from increasing the costs on their credit cards. I mean, they are very sensitive to what you do, and I agree with you. A lot of people are very glib, say, well, just exercise the power of the pocketbook. And I don't quite buy that unless there's some kind of an overall movement, like what happened to Nalgene bottles. The companies that made those just totally freaked out because it just went viral and people suddenly stopped buying them. Absent that kind of a movement, individual consumption decisions, I think, are important because they allow you to live your life authentically by your values of how you want to live, and I don't think you should give that up. But in order to affect change, be a little more instrumental.
Well, Andy, do you think the fossil fuel divestment movement is effective?
I think it's effective in numerous ways. It has provoked the dialogue, and it has shifted the conversation. You know, before you brought up stranded assets. That wasn't in the lexicon before Bill McKibben and the divestment movement brought it in. And that is now in not just activist circles, but you can actually read that in Fortune and Business Week. It is part of the business lexicon. And that's, to my mind, the biggest gift that the divestment movement has created, is getting people to just start talking about this stuff.
All right, last question, please.
Hello. They call me Nate, and for the time being, I live in Ann Arbor. I've heard a lot of speak this evening about belief in science versus disbelief in science. I found in my personal experiences it's inadequate to simply say, I believe in science and you should too. This is what science says. So I was wondering if, for the benefit of everyone here, any of you had a brief explanation as to the most basic physics, like the driving mechanism behind climate change.
We're looking at you, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, you put a greenhouse gas in the atmosphere and it's going to trap heat. That's the reason why Venus is so hot right now. It's got an atmosphere that's 99% CO2, and the temperature there is hot enough to melt lead. It's simple physics. The molecule of CO2 is perfectly designed to keep heat trapped in towards the surface.
And if it helps, you can break this question down into individual elements. Do you believe that global mean temperature is going up? Someone can say no, and you can come back and say, I'm sorry, this one's quite clear. This is a measurement issue. You can say, do you think global concentrations of CO2 are going up? They can say no, and you can again say, I'm sorry, this is a measurement issue. That's pretty much in the category of fact. You can say, do you believe there's a connection between the two? They can say no, and you can say, I'm sorry again, the science is quite clear on this. Now you move to, are humans causing it? And they can say no, and you can say, give me an alternative hypothesis. Scientists aren't stupid. They've looked at all the plausible hypotheses. This is the one they've landed on. If you're going to say it's not that one, give me the other one, because I'd love to know. And then you can move further. What's going to be the impact of this? They can say it's going to be minor. You can say, well, it's a bell curve. Why are you picking the low end of the tail when probabilities suggest it's going to be a much more moderate or high impact? And you can work through it that way as a way of, rather than just, you know, climate scientists go crazy when reporters will walk up to someone and say, do you believe that anthropogenic global warming is real? You've just lumped all these questions together, and it's much more complicated than that. So if you want to dissect someone's thinking on this, break it down into individual questions.
All right. Let's thank our panelists, and thank you very much for coming.